Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again and welcome back. This is the program that tells you about important events happening around the world. And we do it in a way that makes it easy to understand if English is not your first language. Today we have two stories for you. First, we will learn about some of the people who are joining the extremist group, the Islamic State. Where do they come from? Why are they doing this? Then, an interesting story from the United States about who we are and why some people are making major changes to the way they look and behave. As It is coming to you from VOA Washington. Here is part one. Central Asia has increasingly become a source of foreign fighters for militants operating in the Middle East, especially the self-declared Islamic State. The group targets young men in countries with weak economies and undemocratic, repressive governments. Christopher Jones Cruz reports on what causes people to join Islamist extremists and what can be done to stop them from doing so.
The United Nations estimates that at least 25,000 people from more than 100 countries belong to the Islamic State or other militant groups. Hundreds of people from Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, and more than 1,000 men from Kazakhstan, have already joined the Islamic State, which some people call ISIS. Those recruitment numbers come from the U.S. Counterterrorism Center. Congressman Chris Smith is from New Jersey and a member of the Republican Party. He says even government officials in some countries are joining the militants.
Just last week, we learned that the chief of Tajikistan's counterterrorism program, someone highly trained by the United States government, abandoned his post to join ISIS.
Experts are blaming the actions of Central Asian governments for causing people to join the Islamists. The experts note widespread corruption in the area. They also say laws are not fairly enforced and human rights are violated. The experts say a lack of jobs adds to public dissatisfaction in many parts of Central Asia. Extremists use these issues to win followers to their cause. Some militant groups can be skillful in their use of social media. The United States is working with foreign governments to prevent the broadcast of terrorist messages through social media and the cross-border movement of fighters. But experts say there is no easy way to stop terrorists from urging people to join. They say one part of the solution is to work to improve economies so that young people can find jobs in their home country. They say it is easier for militant groups to recruit new members in migrant communities. Daniel Rosenblum is the Deputy U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Central Asia. He says the terrorist groups try to recruit possible new members wherever they are.
While there are no reliable statistics, research suggests that the vast majority of Central Asian fighters in Syria and Iraq are recruited while outside their own countries, mostly while in Russia, where millions of them live as migrant workers.
Frank Silufo is an associate vice president at the George Washington University in Washington. He also serves as the director of the university's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. He says the United States can help other countries fight terrorist recruiting efforts. But long-term solutions must come from the countries themselves.
They're the ones closest to the action. They're the ones who know their communities, and they're the ones who are ultimately going to either detect and or prevent or respond to an incident.
Experts say governments in Central Asia and other areas must improve their human rights records. They say the governments also need to reach out to minorities and get them involved in problem solving. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we come to you every day from Washington. Bruce Jenner, a famous American athlete, was born a man, but recently became a woman. A woman was born white, but says she is black. Should we be able to change our personal identity to meet our needs? Do we have a right to choose our racial identity or sex? For example, if a person's biological parents are white, can that person say he or she is black? If someone is born male, can he demand to be known as a woman? Those questions have been asked a lot recently here in the United States. American Bruce Jenner recently completed a series of treatments to become a woman. Many people supported the former Olympic star's decision to change sexes. But people reacted differently to a rights activist who said she was black. She was forced to resign from her job when her mother and father admitted they are white. Rachel Dolezal led the Spokane, Washington office of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Ms. Dolezal resigned because she made others believe she is a black woman, yet she is biologically white. She told NBC News that she has identified as a black person ever since she was a child.
I would say about 5 years old. I was drawing self-portraits with the brown crayon instead of the peach crayon and the black, you know, black curly hair. And, you know, yeah, that was how I was portraying myself.
Ms. Dolezal's parents legally adopted black children. She was raised with them. Ms. Dolezal married a black man and has 2 sons from the marriage. She teaches classes about African-American culture at a college in Washington State. And she has changed her appearance to make herself look more like an African-American. The discovery that she is biologically white has angered many people. They believe she has unfairly received help because she led others to believe she is black. Greg Carr is the chairman of Afro-American Studies at Howard University in Washington, D.C.
Ms. Dolezal, to use some of the parlance of scholars here in the United States, seems to have acquired everything from blackness but the burden. The story is that now, her whiteness threatens the authenticity that she may have constructed in her own life.
Bruce Jenner was a star of the 1976 Olympics. He has been married 3 times and has 6 children. Earlier this year, he completed his physical transformation from a man to a woman. Jenner now identifies as a woman. Her new name is Caitlyn Jenner. Most people have supported this change of identity. Anne Mourning is a professor of sociology at New York University. She says both Ms. Jenner and Ms. Dolezal will face criticism.
They both have to do with people who run right into conflict with our long-held beliefs about what natural, real categories are, that when it comes to race or when it comes to gender.
Ms. Dolezal told NBC News she believes people should have the right to choose their identity.
The discussion is really about what it is to be human, and I hope that that really can drive at the core of definitions of race, ethnicity, culture, self-determination, personal agency, and ultimately empowerment.
Ms. Jenner's case seems to be a sign of growing acceptance in the United States
that people should be permitted to change their gender. But the case of Rachel Dolezal seems to show that not as many people believe we should be able to choose our racial identity.
You are listening to the Voice of America. We are coming to you from Washington. Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Floods, storms, and other natural events kill thousands of people each year. So does extreme heat. In fact, experts say heat may be nature's deadliest killer. Faith Lapidus and Bob Doty bring us more on heat-related illnesses.
Several hot days that follow each other are considered a heat wave. Experts say heat waves often become dangerous when the nighttime temperature does not drop much from the highest daytime temperature. This puts great pressure on the human body. How have some Americans avoided heat-related disorders, especially if they do not have air conditioners? The most common health problem linked to hot weather is heat stress. Usually, it is also the least severe.
Most people suffer only muscle pain because of heat stress. The pain is a warning that the body is becoming too hot. Doctors say those suffering muscle pain should stop all activity and rest in a cool place. They should also drink cool liquids. Doctors say not to return to physical activity for a few hours because serious conditions can develop.
Untreated heat stress can lead to a more serious problem called heat exhaustion. A person suffering from heat exhaustion loses too much water through perspiration. He or she will feel weak and extremely tired. They may have trouble walking normally. Heat exhaustion may also produce a fast heartbeat, breathing problems, and pain in the head, chest, or stomach. Doctors say people with such problems should rest quietly in a cool place and drink plenty of water. They also say it may help to wash with cool water.
Experts say even a 2% drop in the body's water supply may cause signs of dehydration. These signs include problems with memory and even simple mathematics. The treatment for dehydration exhaustion is the same as for heat exhaustion. Drink plenty of water and rest in a cool place.
Heat stroke is the most serious disorder linked to hot weather. It results when the body is not able to control its temperature. The body temperature increases and perspiration fails. Generally, the body temperature rises to more than 40 degrees Celsius. The body stops perspiring. The skin becomes dry and very hot. A person may become unconscious, not knowing what is happening. Doctors say tissues and organs begin to cook when the body's temperature is higher than 42 degrees Celsius. Permanent brain damage and death may result. Someone suffering heat stroke requires immediate medical attention. Doctors say such treatment is necessary, or the person could die before help arrives.
And that's the health report. For Faith Lapidus and Bob Doty, I'm Anna Mateo.
¶¶
This is Rich Kleinfeld.
And this is Stan Busby with The Making of a Nation, a VOA special English program about the history of the United States. Today, we complete the story of the 37th President of the United States, Richard Nixon.
Richard Nixon's first term as president ended with hope for complete American withdrawal from the fighting in Vietnam. Yet Americans still were very angry about the war and its effects on life at home. Paying for it was difficult. Inflation was high. Unemployment was high, too. Some political observers thought the president would not be elected to a second term. Nixon, however, was sure the American people would support him. He did not campaign in the local primary elections before the Republican convention. Instead, in the winter and spring of 1972, he visited China, Canada, Iran, Poland, and the Soviet Union.
On June 17, 1972, something happened in Washington, D.C. It was a small incident, but it would have a huge effect on the United States. Five men broke into a center of the National Committee of the Democratic Party. The building was called the Watergate. That name would become a symbol of political crime in the nation's highest office.
At the time, the incident did not seem important. Police caught the criminals. Later, however, more was learned. The men had carried papers that linked them to top officials in the administration. The question was, did President Nixon know what was going on? He told reporters he was not involved. In time, though, the Watergate case would lead to a congressional investigation of the president.
For a while, the political conventions of the summer of 1972 pushed the story of the Watergate break-in out of the major news of the day. The Democratic Party met and chose George McGovern as its candidate for president. McGovern was a senator from the state of South Dakota. The choice of the Republican Party was no surprise. Delegates renominated Richard Nixon. McGovern attacked Nixon for his policies about Vietnam. McGovern's anger made many voters see him as an extremist. Nixon won the election of 1972 by a huge popular vote. He would not be able to complete his second term, however. This was because Watergate would not go away.
Early in 1973, reporters found the evidence that linked the Watergate break-in to officials in the White House. The evidence also showed that the officials tried to use government agencies to hide the connection. Pressure grew for a complete investigation. In April, President Nixon ordered the Justice Department to do this. A special prosecutor was named to lead the government's investigation.
A special Senate committee began its own investigation in May. A former White House lawyer provided the major evidence. By July, it was learned that President Nixon had secretly made tape recordings of some of his discussions and telephone calls. The Senate committee asked him for some of the tapes. Nixon refused. He said the President of the United States has a constitutional right to keep such records private.
A federal judge ordered the president to surrender the tapes. Lawyers for the president took the case to the nation's highest court. The Supreme Court supported the decision of the lower court. After that, pressure increased for Nixon to cooperate. In October, he offered to provide written versions of the most important parts of the tape recordings. The special prosecutor rejected the offer. So, Nixon ordered the head of the Justice Department to dismiss him. The Attorney General refused to do this and resigned.
President Nixon had another political problem in addition to Watergate. In late 1973, his vice president, Spiro Agnew, was forced to resign. A court had found Agnew guilty of violating tax laws. President Nixon asked Gerald Ford to become the new vice president. Ford was a longtime member of Congress from the state of Michigan.
By that time, some members of Congress were talking about removing President Nixon from office. This is possible under American law if Congress finds that a president has done something criminal. Was Richard Nixon covering up important evidence in the case? Was he, in fact, guilty of wrongdoing?
In April 1974, Nixon surrendered some of his White House tape recordings. However, three important discussions on the tapes were missing. The Nixon administration explained. The tape machine had failed to record two of the discussions, it said. The third discussion had been destroyed accidentally. Many Americans did not believe these explanations. 2 months later, the Supreme Court ruled that a president cannot hold back evidence in a criminal case. It said there is no presidential right of privacy in such a case.
A committee of the House of Representatives also reached an historic decision in July 1974. It proposed that the full House put the president on trial. If Richard Nixon were found guilty of crimes involved in the Watergate case, he would be removed from office. Finally, Nixon surrendered the last of the documents. They appeared to provide proof that the president had ordered evidence in the Watergate case to be covered up.
The rights of citizens, as stated in the Constitution, are the basis of American democracy. Every president promises to protect and defend these constitutional rights. During the congressional investigation of Watergate, lawmakers said that President Nixon had violated these rights. They said he planned to delay and block the investigation of the Watergate break-in and other unlawful activities. They said he repeatedly misused government agencies in an effort to hide wrongdoing and to punish his critics. And they said he refused repeated orders to surrender papers and other materials as part of the investigation.
Richard Nixon's long struggle to remain in office was over. He spoke to the nation on August 8th.
Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Never before had a president of the United States resigned, and never before did the United States have a president who had not been elected. Gerald Ford had been appointed to the office of vice president. Now he would replace Richard Nixon. On August 9, 1974, he was sworn in as the nation's 38th president.
Soon after becoming president, Gerald Ford made a surprise announcement. He pardoned Richard Nixon. Many Americans criticized Ford for doing this, but he believed he had good reasons. Ford wanted to move ahead and deal with the other problems that faced the nation. He did not want Watergate to go on and on. The case did go on, however. Several top officials in the Nixon administration were tried, found guilty, and sent to prison.
The effects of the case went on, too. Watergate influenced government policy and public opinion for years. For example, laws were passed to prevent an administration from using its power to punish opposition political groups. Intelligence agencies were forced to provide Congress with more information about their activities. And rules were approved to restrict the activities of public officials. The American public, and especially the press, felt the effects of Watergate. Many citizens and reporters felt less able to believe their government. As one writer said, "Never again will we trust our public officials in quite the same way."
This program of The Making of a Nation was written by Jerry Watson and produced by Paul Thompson. This is Rich Kleinfeld.
And this is Stan Busby. Join us again next week for another VOA Special English program about the history of the United States.